This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So the climate on our remarkable home planet is characterized by delayed response and amplifying feedbacks, which is a recipe to lock in intergenerational injustice.
Global warming is accelerating at double the rate measured just a dozen years ago. The target of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial is dead as a doornail. Earth will warm not 3 degrees, but 4.8 degrees C, 10 degrees Fahrenheit. All this and more, according to a new peer-reviewed paper led by famous NASA scientist James Hansen. Other top scientists disagree. Is Hansen right this time? Dr. James Hansen spoke about the new paper at a press conference briefing November 2nd at Columbia University in New York City. Hosting the event was the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network and its president, Columbia's Professor Jeffrey Sachs. You will hear Hansen's presentation and answers to two questions, including Associated Press reporter Seth Borenstein. Seth consulted other top climate scientists who dispute the extreme future painted by Hansen and his 16 co-authors. My comments follow. During his presentation, Hansen cites worries about melting glaciers in Antarctica and high sea level rise as the next approaching tipping point. You will hear Dr. Caitlin Naughton from the British Antarctic Survey, lead author of a brand new paper revealing Antarctic melt cannot be stopped. Here is Dr. James Hansen.
So the climate on our remarkable home planet is characterized by delayed response and amplifying feedbacks, which is a recipe to lock in intergenerational injustice. So we climate scientists have an obligation to explain this situation clearly as best we can, especially to young people, and to include the policy implications. Because if we don't include the implications, people who have a special financial interest will make their own conclusions. The next chart. In 1979, the Charney Report of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences estimated, based on climate models, that global climate sensitivity was 3 degrees Celsius for doubled atmospheric CO2, but a very large uncertainty. Soon thereafter, it was realized that a much more reliable measure of climate sensitivity could be obtained empirically from the precise knowledge of glacial to interglacial CO2 change provided by ice core data. But this empirical evaluation also requires knowledge of global average glacial to interglacial temperature change. And that remained uncertain because of a misleading evaluation of glacial sea surface temperatures that persisted for 40 years. The wrong assumption was that microscopic species in the ocean surface layer would migrate as climate changed, so they would always be at the temperature they prefer today, rather than partly adapt over millennia to temperature change. Now, recently, Jessica Tierney and her then postdoc, Matt Osman, who is our co-author, developed a global temperature analysis omitting the biology data, but using widespread geochemical proxies, isotopes. And Alan Seltzer used noble gas abundances in groundwater from last glacial maximum at latitudes 45 south to 35 north to evaluate global temperatures, or glacial temperatures. In our paper, we show that the Tierney-Osman and Seltzer analyses are consistent, implying a glacial to interglacial temperature change of about 7 degrees Celsius. So next chart, we now know the surface temperature during the last glacial maximum and the forcings that maintained the ice age cold. Together, these imply a climate sensitivity of about 4.8 degrees Celsius for doubled CO2. IPCC's best estimate of 3 degrees is excluded with greater than 99% confidence. This high climate sensitivity has major implications for global warming in the pipeline. The next chart. Clouds, which George will talk about in a minute, are the mechanism in climate models that permits a broad range of climate sensitivities. So, wait a minute. If climate sensitivity is high, how can climate models with a smaller climate sensitivity, which is most models, obtain realistic global warming for the past century? The answer, the second of the two important climate forcings, aerosols, are an unmeasured free parameter, and models with low climate sensitivity can compensate by understating the aerosol cooling. So aerosols are fine airborne particulates. They are a health hazard, killing several million people per year. Aerosols also cool the climate by reflecting sunlight to space, their main effect being as condensation nuclei or cloud drops. They slightly increase cloud cover and make clouds a bit brighter. Humanity made a Faustian bargain by offsetting a substantial but uncertain fraction of greenhouse gas warming with aerosol cooling. Now, as we want to reduce all the chronic health effects of aerosols, our first Faustian payment is due. The payment is acceleration of global warming. Next chart. China reduced its aerosols in the past 15 years, and aerosols from ships decreased in 2015 and especially in 2020, as Leon will describe in a few minutes. So we expect the post-2010 global warming rate to increase at least 50%. Which is the lower edge of the yellow area. If we are right, the 12-month running mean temperature will rise above the yellow region by next spring as the current El Nino peaks. The mean temperature for the rest of this decade will be at least 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, and 2 degrees Celsius global warming will be reached within 20 years thereafter. Although aerosol climate forcing is unmeasured, there is a great inadvertent aerosol experiment now ongoing that helps to educate us. The International Maritime Organization imposed regulations on the sulfur content of ship fuels in 2015 and tightened the regulations in 2020. This should have a detectable effect on clouds, decreasing cloud cover and cloud brightness, and thus increasing the sunlight absorbed by Earth, especially in the North Pacific and North Atlantic regions where shipping is the source of a large fraction of the sulfate aerosols. The satellite data, which Norman will talk about, suggests that absorbed solar radiation is increasing. It's highly variable because of natural variations of cloud patterns, such as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. But since the strong regulations on ships went in effect in 2020, solar radiation absorbed by Earth has increased about 3 watts per meter squared in the North Pacific and North Atlantic. On global average, the solar radiation absorbed by Earth has increased about 1 watt per meter squared. This increase of absorbed solar radiation is the reason that Earth's energy imbalance has almost doubled since 2015. When I gave a TED talk more than a decade ago, Earth's energy imbalance was about 0.6 watt per square meter, which is equivalent to 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs per day. That much energy being poured mostly into the ocean. That imbalance has now doubled. That's why global warming will accelerate. That's why global melting will accelerate. Let's look at the absorbed solar radiation again. If this is not noise, and I don't think it is noise, this 1 watt increase is a BFD, a big deal. Let's compare it with greenhouse gas climate forcing. The greenhouse gas climate forcing on the next chart has increased about 0.045 watts per meter squared per year, which is almost half a watt per decade. So the 1 watt increase of absorbed solar radiation is equivalent to more than a 20-year increase of greenhouse gases at their current high rate of increase. That's why I can say with confidence that global warming will now accelerate. Let's first look at greenhouse gases. Several years ago, IPCC defined a scenario, RCP 2.6, aimed at keeping global warming less than 2 degrees Celsius. And Pushkar will comment on the modeling assumptions that lead to such drastically declining greenhouse gas emissions. But the real world overshot the plan. We could close the gap by extracting CO2 from the air, but the annual cost now has reached $3.5 to $7 trillion based on estimates of David Keith on CO2 extraction. The cost of offsetting the decreased aerosol cooling would be $115 to $230 trillion. Conclusion, the 2 degrees Celsius global warming limit is dead unless we take purposeful actions to alter Earth's energy imbalance. The first thing that we must do is reduce emissions as rapidly as possible. But fossil fuels are providing most of the world's energy, almost 80%. Most of today's emissions and future emissions are from emerging economies, nations that want to raise their living standards. The task is to reduce the carbon intensity of global energy to near zero. But we reduced it only from 0.8 to 0.7 in the past half century. It's not plausible for it to go to near zero by mid-century. Sweden did well by decarbonizing its electricity, in part by building nuclear power plants. Now, my last chart on the fundamental required actions, none of these are occurring. A rising carbon fee is the fastest, most effective way to affect all uses of fossil fuels. But the fossil fuel industry has prevented it. Instead of East-West cooperation, our politics and special interests have led to a focus on economic and military hegemony, which is foolish because we are all in the same boat and will sink together if we don't work together. I don't think that anyone asks young people if this confrontational approach is the kind of world they wish to aim for. The 1.5 degree limit is deader than a doornail, and the 2 degree limit can be rescued only with the help of purposeful actions to affect Earth's energy balance. We will need to cool off Earth to save our coastlines, coastal cities worldwide, and lowlands, while also addressing the other problems caused by global warming. Now, it will take several years for socialization of what is needed for the public to understand, which will be aided by the increasing problems that they will see from global warming. That several years will provide the time that young people need to understand this matter. And specifically, the fact that I believe a political party that takes no money from special interests is probably an essential part of the solution. Young people should not underestimate their political clout.
We are listening to a press briefing with Dr. James Hansen explaining the new paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline. This is Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Jim. Could you, just before we turn to George, just say a word about the 1.5 degree C target and the 2 degree? You said that it's dead. Could you just explain quantitatively what you mean by that to help people understand where we are and where we are heading right now?
Well, in the next several months, we're going to go well above 1.5 C on a 12-month average. Now, as we go from the El Nino to the La Nina, it will drop back below the yellow region that I showed in my chart and may fall as low as 1.4 to 1.3. But for the rest of this decade, the average is going to be at least 1.5. We know that because the planet is now out of balance by an incredible amount, more than it ever has been. You know, it's doubled. So you've got a huge amount of incoming energy. That's what causes the temperature change. So 1.5 degrees is already... It's going to be occurring in the next several months, and the average over the next several years will be at least that level. If there's more energy coming in than going out, the planet is going to get warmer, and we're already at that level. And so far as 2 degrees is concerned, you can see that the attempts to make a plan for how you could stay under 2 degrees, we're shooting way over that. And that was without considering the effect of this additional imbalance caused by aerosols being reduced. So as Pushkar will show, that the scenarios that you would need to stay under 2 degrees are just not, they're imaginary. And the aerosol just complicates it further. We can do it. We will have to do it. But it's going to require the combination of reducing emissions as rapidly as possible. But also, if we're going to avoid Antarctic, you know, there's a, well, I shouldn't go into details, but if we're going to keep sea level close to where it is, we actually have to cool the planet. We can't allow it to continue to be out of balance the way it is now, because it's melting the ice shelves, and we're going to lose the West Antarctic ice sheet if we don't cool the planet off.
Yes, thank you. I have two questions, mostly for Dr. Hansen. When I reached out to a whole bunch of other mainstream climate scientists, people like Zeke Hausvater and Michael Mann, they said, they called your work somewhat hyperbolic. They said it is plausible, on the edge of plausible, or at the high end of plausible, but not likely. And that might be fair to call some of the kinder. But they also, to be honest, say you have a your history is of being right when you're out on a limb. Why are you right this time compared to the mainstream scientists? And then the second question goes into 0.27 degrees per decade since 2010. While that was started out as a strong El Nino year, it also ended as a strong La Nina year. Are you cherry picking a start date here? I know NOAA data shows it's 0.27 since 2010. Why did you choose that date, and how does ENSO factor in to, you know, when you're looking at that change and that acceleration? And thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Seth.
Yeah. Okay. To start with, how do we get these conclusions, and are they fringe? No. You know, it's very simple. The sensitivity is based on now very hard numbers for the temperature change between the glacial and interglacial times, which for decades we thought that the claim was that it was only 3 to 4 degrees. We now know that that's wrong, and the uncertainty is small compared to the change. So the physics there is very straightforward. It's the real world that's telling us what the equilibrium climate sensitivity is, and that's far better than models in which you can get any answer depending on what cloud feedbacks you put in. But as George showed, when you do improve your cloud physics and make it look more like the real world, it also increases the climate sensitivity. So there's every reason to believe that this is not fringe. This is the correct physics, and it's the real world. And it sometimes takes the community a while to catch on. There was another thing about the physics. What was the second part of that?
About the increased warming to 0.27 and the dates that you picked and the evidence.
Oh, well, that was the third part. But let me Let me answer that third part. No, if you look at the temperature change since 1970, it's been basically was a straight line. It's linear from 1970 up to the past decade. And the point that we're starting at, if you saw the charts that Leon showed, and the change in the aerosols occurred from China and from the shipping beginning in about 2010. That's the reason to have that as the hinge point. And it's not at an extreme, at an El Nino or a La Nina. We take the mean of that curve. So there's no, it is an objective way to do it. And the other part, and this may be what I was forgetting about the second part, the physics is very clear. The warming is due to the planetary energy imbalance. So you got more energy coming in than going out. The planet warms up. We've now got we've doubled the imbalance, and that's going to increase the warming rate. Now, it's not simply based on the current imbalance. You have to integrate over time, and you're still getting some warming from additions to the imbalance that occurred 100 years ago. But as we show quantitatively in the paper, you'd still expect at least a 50% increase in the warming rate. And that's what we will soon find out, because, you know, the next few years will show that indeed we do have an acceleration in the global warming rate.
That was James Hansen, recorded at a press conference on the new paper Global Warming in the Pipeline at Columbia University on November 2nd. You can watch the full hour-long press briefing on YouTube. The title is An Intimate Conversation with Leading Scientists to Discuss New Research on Global Warming. Find links to a lot more in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
Let us take a few minutes for some highlights from the paper, followed by some cautions. Global Warming in the Pipeline is a long paper, well laid out and readable for anyone. It begins with a short history of common assumptions developed by American scientists since 1965. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change adopted 3 degrees C as the maximum expected when carbon dioxide in the atmosphere doubles pre-industrial levels. The mainstream assessment first set 2 degrees C warming as the line we should not cross, then said 1.5 degrees C. Well, that's dangerous. Hansen and his co-authors claim a better way to predict what adding carbon to the atmosphere will do. They focus not on CO2 levels, but Earth energy imbalance. More energy is arriving to this planet than leaving it. Most of the extra has been stored in the ocean, but that is just a delay mechanism. The delay, says Hansen, makes the situation even worse. Humans fail to see the impact of increasing planetary energy until it is too late. Now, after decades of neglect and delay, only extraordinary actions can interrupt the physics of a planetary system seeking balance, he says. Even ending fossil fuel emissions right now would not be enough, say Hansen and his colleagues, hinting at geoengineering. The new paper begins, quote, Roger Revell wrote in 1965 that we are conducting a vast geophysical experiment by burning fossil fuels that accumulated in Earth's crust over hundreds of millions of years, end quote. So we unwittingly geoengineered the atmosphere, ocean, and ice systems. Now we are experiencing extreme consequences. Hansen and crew say we need to accept efforts to cool the planet before major cities around the world go underwater and weather becomes even more hostile. An essential question: how much will Earth warm with each addition of greenhouse gas to the atmosphere? To get a better answer, this team used new science to adjust figures used for what is called Earth climate sensitivity. They measure temperature and corresponding carbon levels at 2 points: the peak of the last glacial maximum, around 12,000 years ago, to a point in our recent time in the Holocene, around 7,000 years ago. That is when sea level, as we know it, more or less stabilized, indicating a planet pretty well balanced in energy. But then Hansen's group say something changed from the great cycle of cooling and warming seen over the ages. Here is a quote from the paper. The Holocene is an unusual interglacial. Maximum melt rate was at 3.2 thousand years before the present, as expected, and greenhouse gas amounts began to decline after peaking early in the Holocene, as in most interglacials. However, several thousand years later, carbon dioxide and methane increased, raising a question of whether humans were affecting greenhouse gases. Rudiman suggests that deforestation began to affect CO2 6,500 years ago, and rice irrigation began to affect methane 5,000 years ago, end quote from Global Warming in the Pipeline. Human-induced climate changes may have begun thousands of years ago. Then we found the hidden accelerator in coal, oil, and gas. Now scientists say we created a new age where humans determine the climate, the Anthropocene. A number of current NASA scientists are co-authors of the paper, presenting satellite data on the imbalance of planetary energy. Also at this press conference, Leon Simons, the Dutch Club of Rome member, who identified changes in ship emissions with a speed-up of warming, the kind we are living through now. That is explained in detail in my interview with Leon, January 11, 2023. You can find that free at ecoshock.org. If Hansen and colleagues are right, mainstream science, as represented by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and as discussed at the annual COP climate conferences, they seriously underestimate developing warming, melting, and rising seas. None of the three actions Hansen finds essential to save us are happening. In his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, and in this press briefing, James Hansen warns we are wrecking the future for our descendants. He understands humanity will take a few more years to accept the verdict of planetary reality, but he hopes during that time young people will experience the reality and find ways to cool the planet.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with more on the alarming new paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline. Other top scientists publicly disagree with the results of this paper. From Penn State, the inventor of the hockey stick graph of warming, Dr. Michael Mann says the truth is bad enough without what he sees as alarming exaggeration. In a blog post on this paper, Mann adds, quote, "There is no evidence that changes in ship-based aerosols have played any substantial role at all in recent warming trends," end quote. Mann has a series of criticisms and disagreements with Hansen's paper and the charts to go with them. Scientist Zeke Hausfather has also disagreed with these high estimates of warming in the pipeline. "I checked with some of my science guests on Radio EcoShock. In private correspondence, they said Hansen has been a loner in the scientific community, and he now edges perhaps on cult status rather than consensus. I am not expert enough to judge. I expect a lot more assessment of this paper." Meanwhile, everyone has to admit 2023 revealed truly alarming climate impacts. Flash floods around the world, wildfires that changed the atmosphere, and heat, like no one has ever seen. Not to mention the hurricane that blew up out of nowhere and wrecked Acapulco, and the storms battering Europe. It's too much and too strange to list it all. James Hansen says expect even more of that. You ain't seen nothing yet. As this decade develops, we will find out who is right. You can find more notes, links, and quotes from this paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. In this press conference, Hansen three times pointed to the risk of Antarctic glaciers melting, raising sea levels around the world. James Hansen has promised a sequel paper about rising seas in the pipeline. When asked his assessment of the most important approaching tipping point, Hansen pointed to glaciers in West Antarctica and specifically around the Amundsen Sea there. We are fortunate to have the lead author of a new study finding that pipeline also includes rising seas. Here we go.
It looks like we've lost control of melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet. If we wanted to preserve it in its historical state, we would have needed action on climate change decades ago. The bright side is that by recognizing this situation in advance, the world will have more time to adapt to the sea level rise that's coming. If you need to abandon or substantially re-engineer a coastal region, having 50 years lead time is going to make all the difference.
That is Dr. Caitlin Naughton, researcher for the British Antarctic Survey and lead author of the new paper, Unavoidable Future Rise in West Antarctic Ice Sheaf Melting Over the 21st Century. From Cambridge, Caitlin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a complicated study of invisible ocean currents flowing in dark waters beneath very thick floating glaciers in the polar sea, a hard place to get to. The findings will impact coastlines all over the world. Is that about right?
I'd say so, yeah. The Antarctic is a very difficult region to observe for the reasons you've outlined. And so a lot of what we want to study about this region, we have to rely on models. And in fact, if you want to study the future, your only choice is to use a model.
But we do have breaking science from Peter Washam and his colleagues, published October 27th in Science Advances, about their robotic direct observations below ice shelves in the Amundsen Basin. Caitlin, have you seen that paper, and does it reinforce your work?
I haven't read the paper in question, but I'm familiar with the group and with their approach. It's really exciting what they're doing, sending essentially a robot into ice shelf cavities, and it's giving us a lot of information on exactly how the melt rate varies spatially, which is a very interesting question.
Yes, you've got to keep track of a lot of cross currents, and then some of the waters are coming up, the warmer waters, which we will talk about. They're coming up these canyons that were gouged out by the glaciers, so it's a pretty complicated scene down there. Now, just to be clear, glaciers floating in the sea have already displaced their mass or weight. They don't add to sea level rise, so why the concern?
Because if you thin an ice shelf or you remove it entirely, the glaciers, which are just behind them, flowing over the land, will generally speed up, and they will speed up their flow into the ocean. So that does cause sea level rise. It's kind of one step removed from sea level rise.
Well, just for listeners' information, according to the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado, quote, after the 2002 Larsen B ice shelf disintegration, nearby glaciers in the Antarctic Peninsula accelerated up to 8 times their original speed over the next 18 months, and similar losses of ice tongues in Greenland have caused speed-ups of 2 to 3 times the flow rate in just 1 year. So, Caitlin, are we far enough along in this process to observe speed-ups in the glaciers around the Amundsen Sea due to the ice shelf retreat there, or is that just something to come?
Yes, so we have already observed not only ice shelf thinning, but an increase in the velocity of the glaciers and a loss of ice in the West Antarctic. So the West Antarctic ice sheet is shrinking. We can already see it in satellite observations. It's already contributing to sea levels rise. The contribution of my study was to show that this will not only continue, it will probably speed up.
Well, just to get our geographical bearings here, where is the Amundsen Sea?
It's in the very south of the Pacific Ocean. It's the Pacific sector of Antarctica.
Right, and it's sort of just off the coast of West Antarctica where a lot of the melting is happening. Is that right?
Exactly. It's the region of West Antarctica which is showing the greatest rate of change of ice loss.
In 2014, a NASA study declared the Big Thwaites Glacier was in irreversible decline. Its progress towards the sea was unstoppable, to use NASA's words. What did your new study find is unstoppable?
So my study was looking at the main driver of glacier retreat in this region, which is ocean melting of the floating ice shelves. And we found that not only will this continue over the next century, it will speed up, and it will speed up regardless of the fossil fuel scenario. So even if we manage to meet the most ambitious goals of the Paris Agreement and to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we would still expect to see a rapid increase by about a factor of 3 in the rate of ocean warming and ice shelf melting in this region.
Well, strangely, this new risk of sea level rise from Antarctica is not caused by increasing atmospheric heat at the South Pole or any surface phenomenon like increasing rain. Your paper looks at the intrusion of slightly warmer waters under the floating ice shelves, and those waters are called the circumpolar deep water. Can you describe what that is for our listeners?
Exactly. The circumpolar deep water is relatively warm water. It's about 1 degree, so you wouldn't want to go swimming in it. But in terms of Antarctic oceanography, 1 degree is very warm indeed. It sits offshore in the deep ocean below the surface, about 1 kilometer below the surface, but some of it can flow towards the coastline onto the continental shelf and into the regions beneath ice shelves. And when it does that, such as in regions like the Amundsen Sea, it can cause very rapid ice shelf melting.
This warmer subsurface water flow only changes sea level rise under very certain conditions. It has to reach under floating ice shelves. Is that why your paper says the Amundsen Sea will contribute more to near-term rising seas than other parts of Antarctica?
So the reason that we're concerned about the Amundsen Sea and the West Antarctic ice sheet more generally is because it is vulnerable to changes in ocean temperature. Other areas of Antarctica, such as East Antarctica. The ice sheet is largely resting on bedrock that is above sea level. If the bedrock is above sea level, the ocean can never touch it. But West Antarctica is largely grounded on bedrock below sea level, which means it's vulnerable to the ocean someday coming in and melting it away. This is concerning in the near term because it's a lot easier to melt the ice sheet with an ocean than it is with the atmosphere. The ocean is a lot warmer than the atmosphere in Antarctica. It also has a higher heat capacity. You can see this, for example, if you have an ice cube in your drink, it melts a lot more quickly than if you have it just sitting out on the counter.
That all makes sense. So in April 2023, I interviewed Dr. Matthew England about new Antarctic ocean science, and he said the Antarctic Ocean overturning circulation is slowing down by 30% since 1990. It could conceivably stop, as it has in the past. Does this change the circumpolar deep water we've been talking about and that's so pivotal in your study?
Not in the short term, at least, because the amount of time it takes for the overturning to make a full cycle, if you will, is about 1,000 years. And so this water, circumpolar deep water, is about 1,000 years old. So it won't respond directly to changes in atmospheric temperature for 1,000 years. What will change is how it is transported and distributed around world oceans. And that's what we're concerned about, is the change in the transport of this warm water such that more of it accesses the ice shelf cavity.
Again, melting ice shelves do not add to sea level directly. That comes later. But how much later? And why are there no prediction of the amounts of sea level rise in this particular paper?
Yeah, so this paper doesn't include an ice sheet model. It only includes an ocean model and the way that the ocean melts the ice sheet. Ocean melting of the ice sheet is a major driver of sea level rise, but it's only one term in the equation. In order to put a number on the sea level rise, you also have to know how the glaciers will respond and how snowfall over the continent could change. And we didn't include these processes in our model, but that's a research which we are working on now, and a lot of my colleagues around the world are working hard to combine ocean and ice sheet models so we can include all these processes at the same time and join up all the dots, if you will. In terms of time scale, we think that ice sheets respond relatively slowly. It would take centuries probably to see the bulk of the response of sea level rise to changes in ocean temperature. So 2100 is quite early days, maybe not for ocean warming, but for the ice sheet's response to that ocean warming. You would expect to see the full sea level response closer to 2300, 2500, which is a long time away, but it's still a very significant change to our coastlines, so I don't think we should discount these impacts just because they're far in the future.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
We are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Caitlin Naughton, researcher for the British Antarctic Survey. We're talking about unstoppable sea level rise. Well, let's get to the crux of your paper. Like many studies, you worked out important changes for levels of warming identified in IPCC reports. 1.5 degrees of warming, a middle ground warming, say up to 4.5 degrees C, and the very worst so-called business as usual, RCP 8.5 degrees C of warming. The Paris Climate Agreement assumes if humans limit warming to agreed levels, there will be less sea level rise. But is that what you found?
So it's important to remember that the West Antarctic ice sheet is just one contribution to sea level rise. And we did find that, at least in terms of ocean warming, which is the main driver of sea level rise in according to our study, that isn't strongly dependent on the fossil fuel scenario. Even in the best case scenario, we see this ocean warming speeding up by a factor of 3. But sea level rise is also influenced by other ice sheets, especially the Greenland ice sheet, and also by thermal expansion of seawater. So if you warm up the ocean, it slightly expands. And those terms of sea level rise, we think, are more closely related to the fossil fuel scenario.
I think we've assumed for a long time that the rate of heating determines the amount of ice loss, but you found other natural cycles and events may actually set the pace of sea level rise.
Yeah, so this part of the world is very strongly affected by natural climate events like El Niño, which are temporary, about 5 years cycle approximately, but the timing of them, depending when El Niño and La Niñas happen, that can actually change the warming trend by up to a factor of 2. So while the underlying driver of the warming trend is climate change and fossil emissions, the exact magnitude of the change in ocean temperature in this particular region is also strongly influenced by natural climate variability. So that's a big uncertainty which we cannot control, and we cannot really predict at any kind of time scale.
Dr. James Hansen, formerly of NASA, and his colleagues just published a new paper about global warming in the pipeline. Now it sounds from your work like there's also sea level rise in the pipeline.
Exactly. The sea level responds quite slowly to changes in climate, and so we would expect it to lag changes in ocean temperature by quite a long time, centuries approximately, whereas we also found that changes in ocean temperature lag climate change itself.
You and your colleagues suggest the 1.5 degree C warming scenario is very unlikely, considering we're almost there, and I agree. You also discount the worst case scenario, 8.5, citing a lack of fossil fuels available to get that hot. But James Hansen says up to 10 degrees C of warming is already baked in. There's a lot of debate about all this. But anyway, did your research find a difference for such extreme warming? And when would we be able to see that difference?
Yeah, so we found that the worst-case scenario, RCB 8.5, was the only scenario of the four which was statistically significantly different from the others. So that means if you look at the warming trends in the low and mid-range scenarios, they are indistinguishable. But the warming in the worst-case scenario, RCB 8.5, is significantly higher, about 40% higher. Another way to analyze this is to see at what year does this scenario start to diverge from the others. And it was about 2045 that RCB 8.5 started to take off from the other scenario. So that's still a couple of decades away, at which time the damage to the glaciers could be effectively irreversible.
We've also assumed great masses of ice at both poles serve as a kind of brake to the climate system. It takes a lot of energy to transform ice into water, energy that will not be expressed as immediate heat somewhere else on the planet. The poles have been called the planet's air conditioner. Caitlin Naughton, is that still true?
Absolutely, because there is still a lot of ice available to melt. Even in the worst-case scenario, if the West Antarctic ice sheet collapses, it would take quite a lot more climate change to collapse the East Antarctic ice sheet, and that actually has 10 times as much ice. So it's important to remember that while West Antarctica is very big, it's a lot smaller than East Antarctica.
One of the largest changes in recent years in Antarctica is the sea ice there has shrunk dramatically. Is the disappearance of sea ice happening in the Amundsen Sea? And does that matter to your study?
Off the top of my head, I don't remember the exact regional variation in the sea ice loss this year, but I believe it was roughly circumpolar. So I believe the losses were almost everywhere. But that isn't really relevant to the study, at least not in the short term. Sea ice is really the expression of short-term changes. It responds very quickly to changes in the atmosphere, whereas ice shells respond much more slowly. It's that they sort of filter out shorter-term variations. We're very concerned about the sea ice. We don't quite understand all the drivers and exactly why this year has been so dramatic for sea ice, but we don't think it's directly related to sea level rise, at least in the short term.
If the seas are going to rise, more or less, no matter what we do now, why bother changing our fossil-based civilization that gives us so many things?
Well, because sea level rise is just one impact of climate change. And also West Antarctica is just one contributor to sea level rise. It's important to remember that climate change isn't just one thing. It's a whole set of interconnected systems and a whole spectrum of worsening impacts as climate change progresses. And some of those impacts are unavoidable, and we think that acceleration of the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet is one of those impacts. But other impacts can still be avoided. We think that we can still save the East Antarctic ice sheet. We think it's generally stable as long as emissions don't rise too much further. And other impacts of climate change, like heat waves and droughts, we could presumably stop them getting worse as they roughly scale with global temperature. The problem can always get worse, so we can always stop it from getting worse.
Well, at least we know the sea level rise from that part of Antarctica is coming, and you suggest humans have 50 years lead time to adapt. That sounds like a long time, but we've had 35 years since James Hansen first warned Congress of dangerous climate change, and we've only made it worse during that time. But suppose we get smarter. What could be done to prepare for known Antarctic sea level rise?
I think what could be done is for coastal communities around the world to prepare for sea level rise by either defending against it, so stuff like building walls or other coastal defenses to literally hold back the rising seas, or carefully and slowly abandoning some areas, because it isn't feasible economically or logistically to protect every inch of the coastline around the world. And protecting the coastline is probably something that only the rich nations will be able to do. So I think the international community has to think seriously about the implications of sea level rise for refugees. We already have a refugee crisis in the world, and sea level rise will only make it worse. But if we can plan in advance for where these coastal communities are going to go, that will lead to substantially less human suffering than if we leave it until it's too late.
As we wrap up here, British scientists and explorers have a long pioneering history investigating the last unknown continent, Antarctica. What will you be doing next? And does the British Antarctic Survey have big programs coming up that you would like to tell us about?
Yeah, so I'm on the modeling side of the British Antarctic Survey, that there's a lot of exciting field work happening too. So on the modeling side, something which we're currently working on is, first of all, to combine ocean and ice sheet models so that we can simulate sea level rise directly at the same time as changes in ice shelf melting. So that's quite exciting. And another interesting question is, if the global temperature comes back down in the future, say through massive carbon capture and storage, which is very hypothetical, but I think the direction of travel is that at some undetermined point in the future, it's a possibility that we could suck enough CO2 out of the air that we could bring a global temperature down somehow. Would the glaciers regrow? Because they do respond quite slowly to changes in climate and ocean temperature. Is there some kind of safe period of time in which it's okay to have the ocean warmer and the ice shelf melting faster as long as that is reversed? Or would the ice sheet continue to retreat even if temperatures come back down. Nobody has looked at this question in a couple climate system approach.
Every science fiction writer and everybody who believes in the future will want to know the answer to that question. From the British Antarctic Survey, we have been speaking with research scientist Dr. Caitlin Naughton. She led the new paper, Unavoidable Future Increase in West Antarctic Ice Shelf Melting Over the 21st Century. It was published October 23rd in the journal Nature Climate Change. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Caitlin, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much for the interesting questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Tim Lenton.
If we carry on the way we're going, I can't see this civilization lasting the end of this century. No chance, in my view, on the current trajectory.
Joachim Schellnhuber.
If we get it wrong, so if we do the wrong things, then I think there's a very, very big risk that we will just end our civilization. The human species will survive somehow, but we will destroy almost everything we built up over the last 2,000 years, I'm pretty sure.
Peter Kalmus.
It's just so, the path we're on is just so dark. It's so bleak. You know, I see, tropics that's uninhabitable by humans because it's too hot. It's too humid and hot that our bodies couldn't even survive there. And I see, potentially hundreds of millions of people needing to leave that region and go to cooler areas. And that's just the beginning.
We are, without exaggeration, facing a trajectory and impacts that will obliterate the possibility of human civilization within, by the year 2100. And that is not an exaggeration. And the fact that that is not widely known, that the stakes are so extraordinarily high, I think is something that really, really should cause a lot of people to, from media to scientists to hang their heads in real shame and real horror.
Kevin Anderson.
Recent history supports the view from the IEA, the International Energy Authority Agency, that the CO2 trend is perfectly in line with a temperature increase of 6 degrees Celsius, which would have devastating consequences for the planet.
These tipping points have the possibility. They certainly put forward the risk of a cascade that could take the climate, the Earth system, out of our control into conditions that would be an existential threat to us. Well, if that isn't an emergency situation, I don't know what is.
Everybody on the planet now needs to be galvanized to tackling climate change because it is by far the most important and biggest emergency that mankind has ever faced.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the backseat, too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser.
Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org.